losing someone to suicide. I am Trisha.
And I'm Dawn.
And we're going to kind of pick up where we left off last time, and we're going to start with the things that people say. And we're going to follow up with the fog and awkward silence and get to little letters. So, Dawn, what is, you want to start off with some of the things that people say after a tragedy like this that just kind of rub you the wrong way?
I think one of the things that we have kind of talked about was, you know, whether it be suicide, whether it be miscarriage, whatever the case may be. But when someone says, well, you can always have another child, that just seems to irk me the same way, because you can always have another child, possibly, not everybody. But it's also the fact that you don't forget about the child that you just lost or the family member that you just lost. They are not replaceable. You may be able to take some of that pain away with more joy, but that loss is never going to be replaced.
They're never interchangeable. You know, I heard a quote early on that said, don't fool yourself with your emptiness. There's always more room for joy. And there is. The further you get down the path, you learn that you will be able to find happiness, but you can never replace them. You can never erase them. You can never change what you had with them. So they're not interchangeable. Another child is never going to take away the pain of losing them.
Another one that we kind of talked about was how suicide is a selfish choice. And what are your thoughts on that?
It infuriates me now. Prior to losing her or my nephews, I can honestly say I never put a lot of thought into it. It is, I think if anyone thought that someone goes into suicide lightly, they would have a big misconception of that, because I don't think anybody makes that choice lightly. There is a lot of pain and agony and trauma that goes into that beforehand, before they ever get to that point. So it's not something that they took lightly. It is something it's hard to understand as a parent, you know, like how she got to that point and I missed it. But early on, I was looking for something to make me understand or help me understand where she was at. And I stumbled across a TED Talk. I wish I had written the name down, because to find it again is almost impossible. But it was a gentleman talking about, he had lost someone to suicide, and he was talking about the misconceptions of suicide and how a lot of people will say, how could she do that to you? How could she leave you behind? Or how could she leave her kids behind? Or I can't believe they would do that. And he said, I'm gonna promise you that in that moment, all that was not even taken into the equation. He said, put yourself in a position where, imagine that you're getting hit in the head with a sledgehammer. And the minute your head stops hurting, you get hit again. Day in and day out, you know that's coming, that sledgehammer's hitting you. And the minute you start to feel better, here comes the hammer again. And he just went on to explain that that's a lot of what people who experience mental illness and get to the point of suicide experience. That every day in and day out, is this constant battle for them, and they know that this pain is coming, and they don't know how to stop it, and they haven't found an outlet or someone to help them with this. So when they get to that point where they make that decision, the only thing that they are considering in that moment is how to stop that next blow from coming. They want the pain to stop, and it has zero to do with the people they're leaving behind or the pain that they're causing. Not that they don't care. It's that they are unable at that moment to take that into consideration. So I don't believe at all that it's a selfish choice. And I think that's a huge misconception. And that plays a big part into the stigma of why people don't come forward and say, I need help with this, because you're ashamed or you're guilted.
And I think it makes a huge difference. If you've never been in that position in your own life, you don't understand it. If you've not walked that path, you don't understand. And for us to become judge and jury for that person and what they have been going through is not fair. And I totally agree with you. I I think they're doing the best they can. And, you know, again, if you know that hammer's coming, it's not fair to ask them to keep going through that.
Right.
You know, I would encourage people to get help. Absolutely. I think there are things that can be done if you're willing to do that. But when you're in that state where you just can't feel like going on anymore, I think it's important to reach out. And not everybody has the people in their lives to do that. And some people, you know, my daughter, for an example, she knew she could reach out. She was just so tired of being tired and so tired of the daily struggles that we didn't understand. And I can't be angry at her for that. I'm still trying to understand it to the best of my ability, but it's her journey, and I have to believe that, you know, she did what she thought she had to do. Right, wrong, or indifferent, it's not for me to judge.
Right, and I think this will probably be a conversation for another time, but it also goes back to the way that we teach kids about mental illness, and we talk about it openly and quit attaching a stigma or a shame to it, or quit making them feel less because they're that way, and make it an open door, or make it a normal dinner conversation. Like, how are you feeling today? Are you happy? Are you sad? If we change the way that we discuss it and we feel about it and we talk about it, we open the doors for people that don't normally think that they have a door open. That's a discussion for another day. So, one of the things that you've probably heard 1,000 times, and I never, you know, I'm 43. I've heard it my whole life. I've heard people say it. He only gives you what you can handle, referring to God. God only gives you what you can handle. And I never questioned it. You know, my grandma said it, everybody says it. Shortly after Morgan died, well, 7-8 months, my son was in a horrific car accident. And we almost lost him. He had some major injuries, and we had to drive 3.5 hours to get to the hospital. And when I got there, they escorted me into the emergency room, and I was met by the hospital chaplain, which is a little disarming when you come through that door and that's who meets you. And she gave me a hug, and she said, "You have been through a very traumatic year, I hear." And I said, "Yes, it's been very trying." And she said, "I've heard it's been very rough." And so I knew my son had been talking about his sister, and I said, "Well, they keep telling me he never gives you more than you can handle." And she gave me the strangest look. Now, I'm 43, and I've never had anybody put this in perspective for me. And she looks at me and she says, "Isn't that the dumbest thing you've ever heard?" She said, "That's not biblical at all." She said, "I don't even know where that came from." I'm thinking, well, I'm a pretty smart person. Why did I never question this? Like, and it is a stupid thing to say. Like, she said, "That's not biblical," because she said, "If he only gave you, if you could handle everything he gave you, why would you ever look elsewhere for help?" She said, "You'd do everything yourself." And in that moment, I thought, wow, that is kind of dumb, right? So, but everybody says that. He never gives you more than you can handle. And I'm going to tell you, this definitely is not something that people can handle. I don't care what side of the religion spectrum you're on, this is not one. And that is something that 1,000,000 people will tell you when you're walking through this journey.
And I think too, you know, I've heard people say that you choose the life you live. And when I hear that, I keep thinking, well, I must be a slow learner, because
I did not sign up for this.
We keep getting dealt, you know, trial after trial after trial. And I know that there are things that we need to learn while we're here on this earth. I understand that. But I've gone through miscarriages, and, you know, I've had a child that has been lost. This gives it a whole new perspective when it's an adult child or an adult family member. So yeah, I do use that quote myself sometimes, but having that perspective now and knowing it's not biblical is even better.
And I should have, you know, my best friend of 25 plus years, her husband passed 5 years ago, and the first thing she said when I got to her house, she said, "Don't say anything stupid. Can you just sit here? Just sit here with me." And she said, "I've had enough of that today." And it is not that people ever intend to say things to hit your trigger buttons or things that are going to aggravate you or that you think are stupid. It's people are uncomfortable with awkward silence. They just are. And so when people don't know what to say, because there really are no things that you can say that are gonna make this situation better, they just say whatever comes to mind. I remember, I bet Morgan was gone 4 or 5 weeks, and my mom had called me one night after work. She was calling and checking on me. She said, "How was your day?" And I said, "If one more person tells me everything happens for a reason, I'm gonna hit them in the mouth with a shovel. And when they're picking up their teeth, I'm gonna say, I'm pretty sure that happened for a reason." And first she laughed, and then she said, "Trisha Lee, you cannot do that." And I said, "I'm so sick of hearing everything happens for a reason. There is no reason for this. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life." But it is, you know, and I can think of, I've probably said that a million times. Wonder what people, if they wanted to hit me with a shovel, you know? People never intend to say those things. It's just, when there's no words, that's what comes out.
And I think I find myself more cautious in the things I say now, having been on that receiving end. I sometimes am a little sarcastic and not meaning to hurt people by it, but I use humor as my coping mechanism, and it's not for everyone sometimes. So I think just being conscious of that, and again, kind of going back to the last episode where if something doesn't sit right with you, you need to tell someone. You know, if when you you were talking about everything happens for a reason, I could have taken that defensively, but I've also been, you know, looking at that saying as well and thinking, so what is the reason? Am I supposed to learn something from this? Is it, you know, because of this event happening that you and I connected and we're out here hopefully helping people with mental health awareness and suicide prevention? I do think there's a reason for it. And maybe at the time that it was said, I didn't understand it or I took it offensively. And I think it's all about perception. And I mean, it's hard. You could be on either side of that. So I find myself more conscious of the things that I say.
Right, and it definitely depends on where you're at in the journey you are. Because initially you're super hypersensitive to those sorts of things. And I can recall the first time at work, you know, and it is, I'm sure I've done it. A guy at work was at my desk and he was talking about something going on at work, and just because it's something, it's norm that just happens, and he put his finger to his head and he went, just like, oh, like it's that day. And as soon as he did it, he looked at me and he couldn't find words. He just turned around and walked away. I get it. It's one of those things. Would I hold it against somebody? Absolutely not. It's something you do in passing and you don't think about, but after you've been through this, you really start to think about it. Like, I don't want to ever do that in front of somebody, you know? I don't want to do it to someone else. But it's just some of those things, the further you get along, some of the things that bothered you in the beginning won't bother you now because it is just life. And people listening, they'll figure us out, because that is how we deal with a lot of life, humor, because you can't make some of this stuff up. Like, we have to laugh at it because there's no other way to get through it, right?
So we apologize right now in advance.
No, our parents are listening to this saying, yeah, right? This is our life.
Just keep it clean, I'm sure they're saying. I know one of the other things that we talked about, you know, is the time period. And, you know, when somebody says, well, I can't believe they're still sad about this, or why can't they just get over this? You know, again, if they've not walked in these shoes, they have no idea how this really feels. And this doesn't have to be just a loved one. It could be a friend, it could be a colleague, it could be anyone that you were close to. I mean, love itself can cause grief for a very long time. And it's not something that you get over easily when you love someone as much as you do. And so I think that's, you know, something, whether you've been through a loss or haven't been through a loss, that it's important that you realize that everybody's grief process is different. And we need to be conscious of that.
Definitely. And everybody handles it differently. I am, like, I'll spew, like word vomit. It'll build up and it's got to come out somewhere. And the further I get along in the process, the more I can make it an understandable statement or a conscious thought. At first, it was just come out, you know, everybody's different, the things that hit you or whatever, but I recall like one of my best friend's son saying, "Why is Trisha still so sad?" And she said, "Coop, what happened if you would leave me?" She said, "I would be sad just like her." But, you know, and it depends on the person too. Some people get it, some people don't. But from the outside looking in, it's different. And, you know, both of us have suffered losses and traumas in different ways. This one, there's not one that quite comes close to touching this one. This one's never going to go away, or we may get better at processing it, but I don't think the pain is ever going to lessen.
And I think it's usually just a sudden change, you know. Sometimes people, you know, may die of cancer, or they may pass from a disease or an illness where you at least have time to prepare. Where suicide, you generally don't have time to prepare, and you're not expecting it to happen. And a lot of times we don't see the warning signs that are out there, and we'll talk about that in another episode. But I think when it happens suddenly like that, it makes it more challenging.
It does. It does by far.
I think let's move on to, we had talked about the letters, and both of our daughters left letters behind. And I just kind of want to touch basis on that and how you felt with yours, and then I'll go into ours a little bit.
You know, I heard it from other people, and you know, when nephews didn't leave letters, and everybody said, "Well, God, if I left a letter, I would know," or "I wish they left a letter. It would give me some insight." And Morgan left letters, and I tell you, like when the police officer said, you know, he would deliver those letters, like every part of me was hanging on that one moment that he would show up and I would read this letter, and everything was going to make sense to me. Morgan's letter was very short. I love you and I'm so sorry. Just know that I'm done fighting my demons. I can't do this anymore. And I'm so sorry for what it's doing to you. There was nothing in that letter that was going to ease this pain. Like I'm thinking, oh, the letter's going to solve everything. It didn't solve anything. If anything, it gave me more questions. She wrote a couple letters. The letter she wrote to us as a family was very short, apologetic. "I love you very, very much. Thank you for everything. I'm so sorry." And she wrote a letter to Walker's dad. And that one was, and I haven't read that, and that's his private, whatever. That one was, the police officer said, was a little more in depth about how she wanted him raised and things particular to Walker and what was important to her, and in that he never be disconnected from her family, or that she always be remembered. And so I don't even know exactly what's in that one, but I guess that one was significantly longer. But I guess I was hoping there was something that was gonna settle my heart in that letter, and there really wasn't. So there was a little bit of a letdown there for me. You, on the other hand, got a different kind of letter. Like Brittany put an amazing amount of effort into her letter. Right?
She did. So Britt suffered with a lot of health issues, and those probably started in seventh grade for her. And she's been battling that for a very long time. And when she ventured out on her own, and she was very independent, let me go back to that, and I don't know where she got that, and I'm putting a little sarcasm into that. She wanted to make her own place in this world, and when she ventured out on her own, she wanted to do things on her own, and that also included, you know, she had a job, she was going to school, sometimes full-time, sometimes part-time, but she would put her body at a lot of stress to a point where she ended up back in the hospital, and she would have to, you know, get herself back on track and there's many times where she would have to drop classes because she missed so many of them or what have you. So when she wrote the letter, she basically went into her daily struggles. And one of the things that early on, she had an epilepsy disorder. She had something called POTS, which is post-orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And your blood pressure decreases, your heart rate increases, and you basically pass out. And because of that, she had a lot of concussions, which I believe may have played into that, but we won't know that for sure. She also was recently diagnosed with a connective tissue disorder, so she just had so many things going on. And in her letter, she described her daily struggles, what it was like to get up every morning and, you know, have to sit up slowly on the side of the bed to make sure her blood pressure was adjusted before she stood up. And, you know, if she went out and she was wearing a dress, that it wasn't too low cut, or that she had spandex on underneath so that, you know, if she did pass out, she wasn't being exposed, and just a variety of things. And it made it very easy for us to understand why and how. And she did say, you know, I could have reached out for help, but I was so tired of being tired. And we actually put that part of the letter into her pamphlet, or I don't know what you call it, at the funeral home, so that people could understand as well. Because I think not having answers, sometimes your mind wanders and you think the worst. And I don't think that was the case for Brittany, at least. So we had quite a bit of closure when it came to that. Again, it doesn't make it better. It doesn't change what happened. But I do know that her pain is over, and I can't be angry at her for that. And so, yes, we were very lucky. And then she also left individual letters to some of her close family and friends. And so compared to where you were with your letter, I feel blessed that we received that. And some families aren't even that lucky. Some have no idea what happened. And my heart goes out to them, because, you know, just having a little bit to go off of, I think, is important. And but if you don't have that, I don't want your mind to wander to all the horrible things, you know, that you could have done, or you should have done, or you would have done, because that serves you no purpose.
And that's part of the biggest part of this journey, is accepting where you're at and not where you want to be, because that's hard. It might have been 2 or 3 weeks after her passing, her brother found under her pillow a letter she had started to write to her son. And it was, I assume it is either one she started and then restarted, or she couldn't finish, because it might have been 4 sentences and it just trailed off and it was just done. I can't imagine that that's all she wanted to say to him. So I'm hoping it was just a draft, and or maybe she couldn't finish it, I don't know. But she spent that evening before she did that recording videos on her phone. Like, she would sing to him. So she recorded her singing to him the songs that she sings and telling him she loves him. And so we have those sorts of things, but nothing that would ease our mind as to where her mind was at that night. But, and at the beginning, I kind of rationalized, like you said, with myself, like, gosh, if this was an accident, it would be so much easier to accept, or if it was cancer, or if it was something, it'd be easier to accept. And then, oh, it was 3 or 4 months had passed, and a 14-year-old boy from our hometown died in an ATV accident, and I kept thinking about his mom, and I'm thinking, and that might be silly for me to say, oh, if it was an accident, it would be better. I think the whole left behind is the same. She has something to blame, and I don't. You know what I mean? She can blame it on this accident, this ATV, and this is what happened. Like, I don't know what happened. I don't know where the disconnect happened. I don't know where I lost track of her. I don't know where she lost herself. So I think the whole left behind is the same, no matter how they go. But it's, I don't have anything to be mad at, because I can't be mad at her because she's sick. So I can't be mad. Like, I could be mad at cancer, or I could be mad at a drunk driver, or I could be mad at a car accident. I can't be mad at her. So I think that's the only difference in how they leave.
And so do you feel like that anger serves a purpose?
It doesn't. It doesn't. I just put it initially, I think you're looking for a place to put all of the yuck inside, you know? All the hurt and all the anger and all of the, I feel robbed and she was stolen and how did I live without her? You're looking for a place to place all that. And it comes out as anger and blame. And I have zero people to blame.
And I think that's important for people listening to understand that is, you know, you're going to go through those emotions most likely. It's normal. But you have to learn to let go, otherwise it eats you alive. And our goal is to help you so that you don't get to that point. You know, if we can keep you from experiencing some of those negative things, then we've done what we came to do. It's not a position any of us want to be in. And you do, you look to blame someone or something for taking your child or your loved one away from you. And really what we need to blame is mental illness and what got him here in the first place and why did the system fail or what failed, you know. And I do, I think a lot of that has to do with our system, and we'll get into that in another topic as well. But I think it's just important that you understand that these emotions are normal.
As normal as it gets, right?
Correct.
You get past the anger, and you get past a lot of the other things, and you go into the fog, which is what we'll cover in the next segment. So, I guess we want to thank you for hanging in there with us, and it's been a little bit of a crazy ride. It might get crazier, we're not sure, but we do appreciate it, and we're always here. So if you do have comments or suggestions or questions, please send them to us, because we are more than happy to answer your questions on the air or in private email, whatever you choose.
Thanks for joining us, everyone, and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.